Hello, Mesh Podcast family. Someone gifted me this book called Entrepreneurial DNA by Joe Abraham, a book that I still need to finish reading. Just a brief excerpt from the book. It goes, when it comes to your health, you have genes that drive your predisposition to wellness or disease. There is a genetic code that sets a foundation for who you are. Knowing your genetic predisposition empowers you to make lifestyle and environmental decisions to improve or worsen your health. For example, your doctor can look at your medical history and the results from a series of tests and help you map out a plan for recovery from an ailment. A nutritionist or a personal trainer can help you figure out a meal and exercise plan. A chiropractor or a naturopath can help you put together a wellness initiative. This information actually rings true to the work we do here at Mesh Consulting. If ever you feel as an entrepreneur that your business is ailing or you are deficient in something, we are your nutritionists. Just check our website, www.meshconsulting.co.za, or drop us an email at info@meshconsulting.co.za. Let us map out a wellness initiative, a wellness plan for your business. The book further goes on. Your entrepreneurial DNA is no different. You have a unique set of traits pre-built in your brain. That DNA telegraphs your potential strengths, weaknesses, and tendencies. Being aware of that DNA will allow you to sit down by yourself or with an expert to map out a plan for your business that is perfectly suited for you. It will also allow you to recognize when you are in your sweet spot of giftedness and when you are in the danger zone of trying to be someone you are not. This is my entrepreneurship journey. I'm Difuo Makgele, and welcome. Nima Aya is an artist, technologist, and coach. She is the founder of Policy, an award-winning feminist civic technology collective based in Kampala, Uganda, and serves on Matters Global Women's Safety Advisory Board. She was also recently a practitioner fellow at Stanford's Digital Civil Society Lab and now senior fellow in Trustworthy AI at Mozilla Foundation. Policy uses data, design, and technology to explore the impact of emerging technology on society and vice versa. Nima currently leads the design of a number of projects focused on building data skills, on fostering conversations on data governance and digital security, and on innovating around technology policy. She has a master's in public health from Emory University and has worked on large-scale mobile and digital projects across Africa. Nima, thank you. Thank you for coming to my Entrepreneurship Journey podcast. We are really grateful for you to come and afford us your time. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Nima, let's just jump right into it. What is Policy, your organization, and what do you focus on?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So Policy is a feminist civic tech organization. Originally, the plan was that I wanted to have a better outlet to support governments to use data more effectively, because I felt that, you know, people interact with their governments, but oftentimes, especially in the African context, it can be quite a negative interaction. You know, I would sort of get this feeling in my stomach every time I had to go get, you know, a government document or deal with a government agency. And I was thinking, isn't there a way that data can be used to improve this process, to design these services better? But over time, you know, with any idea, it changed, it morphed, it grew. And now what we have is that we are an organization that looks at how technology impacts our society, especially in the African feminist context, but also how does society impact technology? They go hand in hand. So it's really interesting because we're at a point in humanity where technology is accelerating at an unprecedented rate. But oftentimes, this African perspective is ignored, and there's not enough research, it's not enough thought that goes into how are these technologies that are developed in foreign contexts impacting our society, and what say do we have in how they're built and how they're used, or how can we maximize how these work in our context? So there's so many questions that come into play when you think about technology, but everything that we want to do is from this feminist perspective. So that's my agenda. I enjoy working with women. I want to see women thrive. I want to see women in leadership. So this is what is important to me, because a lot of the times people ask me, well, what about the boy child? What about the men? And, you know, people can go and start those organizations. But for me, this is my passion. It's technology, it's feminism, it's art. And I really, really love what happens at this intersection.
Yeah, I get it. And why the name Policy? How did you select that?
That's a good question. So every time I start an initiative, I spend weeks thinking about a name. And when I came up with this name, I just thought like it made so much sense and it was so intelligent. But oh my God, it's given me so many issues. So the original thought was that it's a combination of two words. The word to poll. So, you know, you poll people to find out their opinions, their ideas, their feelings. So I was thinking about using the word poll, like using the word to get data, and then the word policy, like P-O-L-I-C-Y. So I was like, why don't you combine the two, and then you get a unique word, P-O-L-L-I-C-Y. So that's the original idea behind it. But yeah, the misspellings, I don't know if it's worth it.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. Correct me if I'm wrong. You currently reside in Australia, Sydney, but your organization, your company is headquartered in Kampala, Uganda. How did you manage running a company remotely that you had just started?
Okay, there's some timeline issues there. So I started Policy in 2017. And then I moved away in 2019. So I was only in country for 2 years that I started it. But the intention was always for it to be a remote company. So from day one, I knew it was going to be a remote company. So I think that's important. So in 2019, I moved to Germany. And I lived in Germany for 3 years. And then after that, I moved here to Australia. And I had to move to Australia for family reasons with COVID. Like, it was just a family decision that had to be made. And the time zones are crazy. It's really very we're 8 hours ahead here, or sometimes 9. So it's a pretty difficult time zone, but it can work. So it basically means that I would have the morning free, and then I sort of start working at like 3 or 4 p.m. and then I have to go late into the night. But one other important information that I should actually give is that when I started Policy, so I already said that it was always going to be remote. That was one thing that was baked into it. So for example, when COVID hit, it didn't really affect our operations in any way, because we were already a remote organization. And in fact, we grew significantly during COVID, because it allowed me to be even more remote, if that makes sense. Like, it allowed me to hire people from other countries and to really get the best of the best. And it really helped us grow. But the other thing that I should add is that I actually stepped away from running Policy last year. So I stepped down from my role as the executive director in August of last year, because the plan was always to only run Policy for 5 years. So it was to set up something and to run it for 5 years, and at the end of that, to move on. But then I didn't really hit my 5-year target. So I actually stepped down after 6 years and a few months, maybe 6.5 years. So, but it was always in the plan that I would eventually step down, whether I would have been in Germany or Uganda or something, because I really enjoy the entrepreneurial side of starting something versus managing and running something. So I think that's just who I am as a person.
I do understand. And your primary career is in epidemiology and research, MPH. What are some of the lessons you learned there that you took with you and enabled you to start Policy?
Yeah, good question. So the crux of Policy's work is research. So we, as I said, we're obsessive about the impact of technology. And so for that, we have to do research, and we're trying to do high quality research, whether it's quantitative or qualitative. And as an epidemiologist, those are all the skills that I learned. You know, it's statistics and some. And so that was just a perfect skill to have, to work with data. So I had no idea at the time when I did my MPH that that was what I was going to do. But I did epidemiology because, you know, it sounded interesting. And, you know, the study of diseases on a mass scale, it sounded quite interesting. I never did work in epidemiology. It was just not a career that happened for me. But those skills have been extremely transferable and extremely useful. And I think everyone should take courses in statistics because it will always, always be useful.
Right. And not to be repetitive, but then you changed and went to be an entrepreneur, especially in tech and focusing on and women. How did you come to that? Was it an easy decision? Was it an easy transition for you?
It was, but as I said, it wasn't a natural one. It wasn't, I didn't wake up and decide I was going to work on tech and women. I woke up and decided I was going to work on data and governments. And then, of course, I was young and starry-eyed. And I think everyone should be young and, you know, have, I think, I'm going to go on a different tangent for a second, but I think there's something extremely beautiful about being young and optimistic. Because I started policy in my 20s, I'm now in my 30s. And once you've seen the world, you become a little bit pessimistic a little bit, or like, you know all the things that can go wrong. And that stops you from doing things because you're like, oh, that could go wrong. And then I'd have to pay too much tax. And then like you've seen the world. But then when you're younger and it's just everything feels possible. And it is possible because you have that energy and that belief. So, yeah, I was young and I was like, yes, I will work with governments and I will work on data and it'll be amazing. But of course, it's not easy to work with governments when you're not bringing money to the table. And so I actually ended up going to this workshop where I learned about feminist internet and feminist tech. And I thought that was super interesting. And that's when I made the pivot and I started working on women and tech. And I absolutely loved it. I've always been a feminist. I've never studied it. Like, I never went to school to study feminism, or I didn't read feminist books, but like deep inside my heart, I knew that I always wanted women, you know, to have an equal education and equal jobs. And I firmly believed in that. And so it just became very natural that, yes, this is super exciting. Women in tech. I've always been interested in tech. Like, I've been playing video games since I was like 2 years old. I think the reason I think about my schooling as a misguidance in some way, because I think that I was just at the wrong time. I was at a time where honestly, there was no guidance for me to go into tech. Nobody advised me that, you know, you enjoy tech. Why don't you do that as a living? I was always advised to go into health and medicine and to do something caring. And, you know, people would be like, oh, you're so good with kids. You should be a pediatrician. And that was the advice I got. And obviously I took it. And so I feel like I did it, but it wasn't what I really wanted to do. But I had no role models. I had not seen any woman in tech. I didn't know what careers were possible. I like a lot of the careers now in digital rights, like we didn't know these were going to be careers at all. That what I do now, if I knew that as a kid, like this is what I could be doing, like I would definitely have studied computer science or something along those lines. But it really comes down to who are your role models and who do you have in life to send you in the right direction. So for me, it was a bit of a divergence and then coming back onto the path that I actually like.
Oh, Nima, you don't know, you just hit a nerve. I can relate so much to that. And I wish and it's my hope that someone listening to it, to this, who could be in the same situation, you know, has the confidence and to change that trajectory and be who and what they want to be. Thank you for saying that. And
I don't blame my parents for anyone. It's that they are, I fully understand that parents are scared for your future as well. Like, you know, I'm an artist as well, right? So I love doing art and I was absolutely discouraged. Like they were like, no. You can't do art. Art is a hobby. And I get it. I get it because your parents are worried about your financial future. And I especially empathize with parents of today as well, because the future is so uncertain. You have no idea what the jobs of the future are going to be like. What is AI going to take over? So at the same time, I have a lot of empathy for people trying to guide young people, because it is very confusing right now.
Yeah, it is. It is. My primary career is in medical science. And I carried on with that up until one day I thought, you know, there is no use being unhappy. Because if this is your career, you live is something you live, you know. And there's no use complaining all the time. Just go for what you love. And if you want to change, if you want to reinvent yourself, do that. And it seemed like I'm crazy. Then, or I'm irresponsible, but I thought, you know what, I'm just going to honor myself and be true to myself. And it doesn't look, it isn't an easy thing to do, but you just have to have the guts and just follow your heart. And thank you for saying that, mentioning that.
Yeah.
And we hear of the term civic technology. You talked about going to government offices and there's papers and there is no data and but not many of us really understand the term civic technology. So what is civic technology?
Yeah, so civic technology is, in my view, it's any technology that can help citizens in how they interact with governments. So there's also like a number of words, like some people call it gov tech. So it's like, yeah, the other side, it's like the tech that gov uses. Some people call it public interest tech, for example, like technology in the interest of the public. But it's any, I feel like it's any technology that supports the interaction between citizen and government. And it could be anything, like, for example, when you go to get your visa, you know, e-visa services, that's an interaction. Or you get your driver's license, or you get your house, your land title, depending on what country you are, and it's digital, for example. So it doesn't always have to be digital per se, but it is like in some form using technology to ease the process. So instead of driving and sitting in traffic and going to your local government office to file your taxes, you just submit it online without ever leaving your house, for example.
Yeah.
But it's not just about those services. It's also making them user-friendly. So if there's, you know, a lady in the village who does not speak English or whatever the predominant colonial language is, but the service is still available to her in her local language, or if somebody is not, cannot hear very well, that there's some, or see, there's some service that helps them with whatever disability they have, that they can still use the service. So it's not just a matter of building tech, but really building tech that is humanist in nature, that is tailored to the actual needs of those very citizens. And it's anything that just improves the service that you receive, you know, and I think we just need a lot of that, because there are a lot of uncomfortable touch points with government. I think a lot of, especially in the African context, like a lot of civil servants always act like they're doing you a favor. But it's actually a lot of us are paying taxes and we're doing you a favor and you have a job and you you should, you know. And the thing is, you go to other countries and you see, like when I lived in Germany, our local town, you know, they had this really nice office. And you got a little ticket and maybe you waited 5 minutes and then you went to this comfortable desk and they spoke to you nicely and they helped you with whatever it was you wanted in a very polite manner. And you got the thing done. And it was like, why can't the rest of us have this? Why can't we be treated on a basic level nicely? Why do we have to go into a shed and be hot and be sweaty and be yelled at? And
oh, Nima.
There's a different way of doing things. And I would like to see that happen.
Which takes me to our next discussion. Do you see the civic tech being fairly adopted by governments, specifically here in Africa?
I think there have been huge strides, I have to say. Like huge strides, especially like in Uganda, where policy is based. There have been, massive strides. Like, you know, we do our taxes online, we submit a lot of our paperwork online, You can get work permits, visas, you can do that process online. A lot has been digitized. And there are certain offices that just work really well. And I guess it comes down to leadership at the end of the day. But yeah. I think the changes in Uganda are very, very, you can really see that things are happening, things are changing. There's some people in there that are doing a great job. I can't speak for all countries. I know all countries are trying to some extent. Some are getting it right, some are not. But yeah, it's a journey. And I think all countries all over the world are trying to figure it out. I think moving forward, like questions of privacy and safety and security might become bigger issues as well. But it is nice to see the changes that have actually happened.
Yeah. And obviously these changes, when you look at our African landscape, they need, you know, good or robust internet infrastructure. And we see fast internet like Starlink being it has been adopted by some African countries, but it's not being adopted. It's actually been banned in some countries like Niger, South Africa is one of them, Ghana, Botswana, Zimbabwe, you know, because of regulatory issues that they're saying, no, this isn't in line with our regulation. I don't know if I don't know what to think about it. If I know recently some that were, you know, accessing the internet, maybe roaming it from other countries where Starlink is being used, like Kenya, Zambia, they got disconnected recently because it's not allowed. And if this is an internet that can be used in remotest of places, you know, I don't know if we are moving back or we are moving forward. I don't know. It's just a little bit... Yeah, it's a little bit confusing. I know it's politics, but I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if we are. Yeah.
I don't know enough about Starlink. I haven't really been following it, but I mean, a lot of countries have really dismal internet. Like, a lot of, like, yeah. I mean, in Uganda, oftentimes you leave, like, capital cities or you leave major cities and there's just no internet connectivity.
There isn't. Yeah.
And then, yeah, even when you're our office is located next to an internet service provider in the same compound. And then there's so many times where our internet doesn't work. But people really suffer. It's really poor connectivity. The cables are being cut underwater. Yeah. I think it needs a lot of investment, like a lot of investment to improve the internet and to, it's... It needs a lot of investment. It's and something you would hope that over the years it would get better, but it does somehow seem to. I don't have the numbers, but anecdotally, it feels like it's getting worse.
You know, Nima, you talked of exiting policy, but you know, not like exiting totally. But you have garnered awards since founding a policy. Like Mozilla Foundation, Stanford's Digital Civil Society, you're in fellow there, you're in Top Africa Innovation List. You will tell us more about those. But these recognitions you've had, have they now somehow helped put your organization on the map?
That is a good question. Do I have the right answer? I can't say one way or another, to be honest. Okay, I guess maybe if I frame it, would the organization have reached where it is without those awards? Yes, I think it would, regardless. But those awards, what is interesting about those awards, it's not just the award, but it's the network that it introduces you to. So for me, the most important thing is network. Right. And, you know, who you meet and who you know. Like for anyone young listening, anyone of any age, let me not discriminate on age. When I go to a conference, I think the most important thing is that I meet people and I form connections with the view of working in some way together in the future. Like I think that is the most important. Like when I was doing my master's, I remember... Like, I did my master's quite young because I graduated during a financial crisis. So, I remember people telling me, like, oh, the whole point of your master's is the networks. Like, you do a master's, you know, to form these, like an MBA or whatever.
Ah,
and I was young and I was like, whatever. But honestly, so true. Like, so much of what you can achieve, it comes down to your networks. And it's not like, it doesn't mean that you know, you're 21. Like, who am I going to know? Who am I going to meet? It's still so important who you, like, you can be friends with another 21-year-old, and then 10 years later, they're somewhere that you want to collaborate with. And it's not in the sense like, oh, you're using people for something in the future, but it's really important to build strong networks in any case, because, and I also, becoming a little preachy, but also just being kind to everyone. I see this all the time where, like, for example, when I was starting out, like, just the way people, like, didn't respect my time or didn't see a point in engaging with me, for example. You know, maybe if I went to a conference, people were like, oh, I don't really know who she is, so I'm not really going to give her the time of day. But not doing that. Like, everyone you meet is worth understanding and knowing, because you just never know where you're both going to end up in, like, even 1 year. You just have no idea. So it's like, make good networks and be kind when you can. And I think that that is really a way for you to grow whatever it is you're doing.
Yeah, true. And you know, we cannot talk about technology and not mention artificial intelligence. You know, it's this big thing happening. And in the UAE, for some years now, they've had a minister of AI. I don't know if it's to regulate this, but when you look at the landscape on a macro level, do you think this is what other governments should be looking at, you know, to have regulatory bodies in terms of AI, you know, for policy and regulation? What are your thoughts about that?
I think I wouldn't say you need to have a minister of AI per se. It does feel like it's a lot of hype at the moment. I would say you do need government regulation on any emerging technology. On a macro level. Yes, I think any new technology that happens, we need to understand it. We need to see the pros, the cons, the usefulness, the applicability, absolutely. And also, you need to understand how you are going to regulate it. Because if you don't come from an informed perspective, either you get blown away by the hype when nothing is actually happening, or you come from a place of fear where you're like, oh, I don't really understand what's going on, so maybe I should ban it or something like that. But I would love to see governments having, like, yes, we have ministries of ICT, ministries of IT, whatever.
Right.
Like, really dedicating resources to understanding the tech and regulating it in a smart and informed manner. I think that that is super important because, yeah, it's a lot of hype, and there's a lot of other stuff that is going on in general around technology that we've not even addressed, for example. And yes, AI does amplify it further. So, you know, if you take misinformation and disinformation, that yes, with AI, you can, like, max it. You know, you can create so many bots and create so much content and translate it to all these different languages and spread disinformation at an unprecedented rate. But I mean, when you think of many African countries, as we already spoke, we're literally struggling with internet access.
Yeah,
you know, we're struggling with people getting digital literacy to even go on the internet. We're struggling with women and the digital gender divide. Like, what? Just because there's something new and sexy, it doesn't mean we've solved these other structural issues that we still need to target and to solve. So it's, I guess in some ways it feels like a distraction. Like, it's really distracting ministries that need to be focusing their energy there on just providing internet, for example. So, I would say no to a minister of AI.
Yeah. So I read, you know, I was thinking, because there's so many, we get so much bombarded with so much information, and people saying, what are we going to do now when this AI becomes, you know, sentient and it transcends our human intelligence. And if nobody's looking out, all these smart tech people can do anything, you know, and there's no one stopping them. And and we moved from this AI is going to take our jobs and we're all going to be unemployed. And there's a lot of things going on. But I hear what you're saying. We here in Africa, I mean, let alone AI, we have connectivity issues. We have service issues. You know, our governments in my country, Lesotho, where I come from, I have to drive to the next district to renew my driver's license. And when I get there, you're told there's, we are out of paper, we are out of something, and you wait. And
yeah,
I mean, there's so many things we need to fix and have a look at. But notwithstanding that, we also need to not somehow catch up, but be at a certain level in terms of technology use. And I commend companies such as yours, Policy, for doing this. You know, I read a blog that you wrote recently on use of AI or, you know, ChatGPT in companies. If you're asked to give a report and you just go on ChatGPT and copy and paste everything. Can we explore that piece briefly? Where do we draw the line?
A can of worms.
Where do we draw the line?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
The thing is, so I use ChatGPT almost daily. Like, and people are like, what do you use it for? But just something. I have a question or I have something I want to rewrite or draft something. Or it's even better than a Google search, honestly. You go on Google search. You have a simple question. How do I get tomato ketchup stain out of my white shirt? These are the problems I have. And you go to ChatGPT, it gives you like 5 easy answers. You go on Google, it's like 50 ads, you know, to just see, to read one page, just ad after ad after ad. It's nauseating. I mean, I guess it's a matter of time before ChatGPT starts showing you ads. But anyway, for now. It's easy to navigate. But the problem with that is that I can always spot when somebody has used ChatGPT to write something. And it's soulless. There's no, obviously it's soulless. It's a computer. It's, and so people write these, whatever it is, there's their report, their LinkedIn post, their strategic plan. And you can see that this is written by a computer. And it really messes with you because you're like, it doesn't read well. It doesn't look well. Also, it makes me question what you're doing. And I think for me, it's also a bit conflicting because on some parts I'm like, it is unfair that everyone has to be judged by their grasp of the English language. It is unfair for sure.
True.
And that ChatGPT definitely improves texts that people have written. But if you start from ChatGPT, that's your starting point. Like, you've not actually written anything with your own brain and then gone to ChatGPT to fix it for you. You're actually going to ChatGPT to write the whole thing for you. It's completely soulless. It's so, totally see-through. And I think the other thing that I'm also, and I'm not saying I have full opinions on this because I think these are new technologies and I'm still coming to grasp with it myself. And as an artist myself, when I see people using generative AI on their reports or whatever, I really do feel some kind of way. You know, it's because, like, I mean, I can give you an example where I'm in like the subreddit for writing. I just like to be on it too. I'm always in the process of writing a novel, never finished one. Anyway. But I'm still in the group just to see what other people are doing. And at some point, like, some of the writers were complaining that, you know, they've had less jobs because of ChatGPT. But then the same writers will use generative AI to make images for their book covers. And it's like, don't you see it's the same thing? It's the exact same thing. You're doing it to another industry where you're suddenly saying, I don't need artists, I don't need designers. But then all you end up with is things that just look the same. It's like same. I don't know. It's just creating a lot of rubbish content in the world. And it's like we already have so much rubbish content. But yeah, and then I have conflicting views on this. And
I think we call it how the technology changes. Yeah, we call it what it is. It's plagiarism. It's repetitive. Take something that is in your views at all, and you put it there, and you pose it as your views. So that is what is plagiarism is. But it's just now tech based, or I don't know. But I hear you.
It's acceptable in some way, right? I think it is nice to see people's writing styles, you know, just uniquely how people write, how people think without it going through this filter of AI. But I think the other weird thing is, the blog post that I actually wrote was thinking about how organizations are going to accept the use of AI, because we had a colleague who would write us AI emails, and it was super easy to see it was an AI email, because for like 3-4 years, we've received his emails. We know what he writes like. And then they would suddenly be a totally different type of emails after ChatGPT was released. and then it's just like, well, this is not okay. But the question was like, why is it not okay? Mm-hmm. Like, they're still communicating with you. But it just felt like I was talking to a computer. It felt like I was talking to something that's not human. That's what it felt like. I think that was the unease of the whole thing, is that I'm not communicating with a human being, and so what is the point of communication if I'm talking to a robot? I guess. But then, you know, is that just our future? Are we all just going to be talking to robots anyway? Is this person actually ahead of the curve? I don't know.
It's confusing. It is confusing. I wouldn't want to talk to a robot, you know, especially it's like pretense and you're pretending. It's just an email, and just write an email.
But I mean, a lot of people are making money from that. Like, you know, there's the AI girlfriend, AI boyfriend apps where people are talking to robots and getting comfort or alleviating their loneliness in some ways. So
interesting. You guys are doing amazing work at Policy currently, but now that you wouldn't be there full time, what is next for Policy, or next for you?
Two very different questions. Okay. I guess Policy will continue to do what it's, you know, set out to do, feminist internet stuff. Yes. The interesting thing with a company like that is there's always, because of just where we are as the human race, there's always going to be some new tech. And there's always going to be a need to understand how it impacts society. So it sort of feels like there will always be work to do in some sense, you know, and it will always be interesting, because we've always gone with the trend, you know. So if right now it's AI, so AI is out there, how does AI impact African women?
Yeah.
How can women benefit from AI? What is there other than ChatGPT? There's so much more to AI than just generative AI. And then in 6 months, I don't know what new tech there'll be, you know? And then we'll have to talk about that. So it's always going to be something new and fun and exciting. And I think that's what makes it really, really fun. And it's always about trying to make that information accessible to more people, to bring more people into the discussion. Like, a lot of what we've been trying to do is, you know, feminist organizations they've been organizing for years, you know? But we need their voices when we talk to tech platforms. We need them when we talk to governments, because they have the experience. But then oftentimes they get scared away by the tech. They'll be like, oh, I'm not really a techie. I don't really know anything about this. But you bring such a unique view that we need to bring to the table to talk about how tech is impacting our society. So it's this need to bring a wide variety of stakeholders together to talk about how technology is going to impact you, because you can't stay away anymore. Everything is online. Everything is touched by technology. So there's no point in trying away. And then for me, I'm starting something new. It's been a long time. It's not a long time in the making. I've just been spending a couple of months trying to decide what I want to do next. Yes. I think it's I did consider going back to employment. I thought it would be interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm. But I will not. I think I've either had jobs that were where I had a lot of independence. I did the entrepreneurial stuff. So I do feel I might struggle if I had to go back into employment, but maybe it would be less stressful, which would be nice. I feel like I'm in my non-stressful soft life right now.
Yeah.
But no, I couldn't stay away from it. I can't stay away from the I like it. I like the anxiety, and I like the stress a little bit that comes from starting something new. I think it's a little bit addictive, I guess.
I don't know where I read this somewhere. I don't know where, maybe probably on X, Twitter, where they said it's so hard to employ an entrepreneur. Not hard to employ, you can, but it would be hard for them somehow, because they are used to this freedom and independence. Independence in thinking, you know, cognitively. And when you put them back in the employment sector, where everything is especially in places where you're micromanaged, and it can be really a challenging. But I hear you completely. I hear you well. and Nima, in closing, what is your favorite book, or even if it isn't favorite, but a book that you have read that, you know, that made a change in your journey, or you can think of that was pivotal in your journey of entrepreneurship that you can share with us or recommend?
Yeah, I struggled a bit with this question, to think of a book that particularly impacted my journey. I really struggled for a long time to read nonfiction. Like, I think I only started reading nonfiction in the very recent past, because I often feel like, I'm going to sound like such a hater. I feel like a lot of nonfiction books, especially aimed at entrepreneurs, are oftentimes, it could just be like a 10-page paper, but it's expanded into a 300-page book. But I've always been much more a fan of fiction. I think through fiction, you can just learn so much more about the human condition. And I think that is somehow important to entrepreneurship. But one of the things I actually wanted to do when I stepped down from policy was that I wanted to write the book that I wish I did have access to, because I realized that I learned so much on the job, which you have to do anyway. I'm not saying that there's any shortcut to that. The only way through is through. You got to do it to know it.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot that I had to figure out myself. And it does. When I look back, I'm like, I didn't have to figure out myself. Like, everyone is doing this, you know, like people before me have had to do this. But then when I think about, like, what resources did I have, like specifically to starting a business or a nonprofit in Uganda, to understand the system there, and maybe to extrapolate that to other African countries, or maybe East Africa. I think that I could not find a book that had that all in one place. Like, the fact that you would, like, how do you make, this is something that even my finance managers struggled with. Like, how do you make a budget for a donor for the type of research that we do, you know, for example, or how do you do an audit? How do you organize your files? How do you do your taxes? Like, all that stuff. It's pretty boring. I'm not gonna deny it, but it has to be done. There's no way around it. Wherever you are, you have to do that stuff. How do you approach donors? How do you get funding? How do you write winning proposals? Like all of that stuff. And I've learned so much of that. And I feel like someone needs to write that book. And it needs to sort of be like a living document, you know, of would actually almost be nice if it was like a collaborative living document that people could really benefit from. Because there's some people who know these things and they can get way ahead based on, in general, if you have the skills. But all that to say that I do not have a book that helped me specifically, but I wish I did. But I will share a book that I quite really enjoyed. It's called Girl, Woman, Other by Bernadette Evaristo. Let me make sure I'm spelling her name correctly. Oh, no, it's Bernadine Evaristo. Evaristo. And it's a book that's like a collection. It's one story, but within it, it follows the lives of 12 different women. And just like, their struggles, and they're different ages, from different areas, from different backgrounds. And I really, really enjoyed it. I also, one of the things about the book is that it plays around with the very structure of sentences. Like, there's no punctuation in the book, for example, but then you realize that it doesn't really matter. You don't really need punctuation, apparently, and that you can perfectly read a book. Super interesting. It's really well written. It's really enjoyable, and I would just recommend everyone to read it. Like, it is the perfect gift. If you know someone who has not read it, it's just a perfect gift to give them.
Wow. Nima, thank you. And please, when you get the time, write that book. That book you wish you had. I feel like it would be something, I don't know if a handbook, but it would be something that would really be helpful to a lot of people. Please, I know you will. I know you'll get to it. Thank you. Thank you so much. I do. 100%. Thank you for being here with us, Nima, and dispensing this insightful nuggets about your organization and civic technology in general. Thank you for affording us your time. I cannot thank you enough.
You are most welcome. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation. I really like the questions. And I wish you the best of luck in the rest of your episodes.
Thanks for listening to our show this week. If you enjoy our show and would like to support us, help us by spreading the word. Tell your friends about Merge and engage on social media. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is at Merge Podcast. Merge My Entrepreneurship Journey on LinkedIn. If you would like to engage with us privately, drop us an email at defuo@mergepodcast.com. Remember, we are available and streaming wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Defuo Makgele, and you've been listening to My Entrepreneurship Journey.